I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Anthony Dieter and George Alexander. Anthony is Plains Cree, originally from Saskatchewan, Canada. He is chair of the art department at Claflin University. George Alexander is a Muscogee artist from Tulsa, Oklahoma. They are both part of Indigenous Fine Art Market, which starts today at the Rail Yard and goes through Saturday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, both of you have been part of Indigenous Fine Art Market, which accompanies Indian Market, but is a different thing. What's it about?
I think the best way that I could describe it is just another place for Native American artists to let their voice be heard in a different light, I guess, because I mean, the Rail Yard kind of gives like a different feel to it as opposed to the other Indian Market. It's a little bit, I feel it's more contemporary, and it brings out new, different artists that some people may have not have seen.
Right, and if I may say, you know, it's for myself, you know, with all due respect to Swaya, who are, you know, many good friends of mine are in that show. You know, they're some of the most talented individuals I've ever showed or worked with are in that show. Indigenous Fine Art Market, was my understanding, was to give some artists who may not have had the opportunity that Swaya had offered over the years. The word contemporary keeps reappearing. So there may be some medias that, you know, you wouldn't see in a Swaya market, but you may see in an IFAM market. Particularly, I'm seeing digital photography, people doing alternative types of media. So you may not see that in a more traditional style show, although, you know, the talent is every bit as much there as in Swaya. You know, Swaya, of course, having some of the best out there also. So.
Well, your work is a great example of that. I mean, you do painting, sculpture, 3D animation, digital photography, and I wanted to ask you about that. Like, how did you come to doing all these different media, and how do they interact and support each other for you?
Well, you know, it's a long journey, to be quite honest. I was a tradesman before I was ever an artist, and part of that was in the high-tech industry and in the construction industry, and I married my trade past with my art there, and some of the technical aspects of 3D animation or of digital ultimately relied on my trade background and experiences as a tradesman at one point in my career. And then it occurred to me that ultimately, and perhaps I'm sure George would agree, you know, we're storytellers. And the storytelling component, I was like, wow, I'm not limited to one media here. While I started off as a painter and ultimately I'm returning as a painter, the journey's been one through, you know, tech school, through learning digital animation at the University of Wisconsin, to teaching at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And I'm going, no one said we needed to tell a story in one media when you can marry them all together, and perhaps that is one of the strengths of Indigenous Fine Art Market, of people bringing that to the table.
I loved your story about how you grew up in a place where people were expected to be tradesmen, but your father was really a very talented artist, and he was a hunter, and he would draw the animals that he was going to hunt.
Oh my goodness, yes. We grew up in a, I honestly feel, and I never lived this down with my family, I'll tell you the story some other time, but we grew up in probably at the tail end of an era where hunting was actually a means of subsistence with our people, and I think I caught the tail end of that. Yeah, because now we have, you know, the big fancy Walmarts and everything like that, but yeah, what happened is my father, who was a drawer, would often tell me stories of hunting or being out with his buddies, and while he was doing that, he would sketch with his hand, and he'd draw this perfect white-tailed deer, and I'd be like, oh man, Dad, that's so wonderful. Then he'd just say, and I did this right here, and then he'd draw right over it and just ruin the whole drawing, and I'd go, oh my gosh, Dad, I wanted to save that. And he did that a lot, but I think that's, you know, my mother and my father brought that talent, because we were in the 60s and 70s on a reservation when I was growing up. We didn't even have a TV in the house, so drawing was our form of entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. And so you then became a tradesman, but then you ended up going to IAIA, the Institute of American Indian Arts. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, I'd come off the tail end of working in Vancouver, Canada, in the trades. I was in the construction industry, and multiple times foremans. I was a bit of a joker on the crew, so I'd do like sketches or I'd do something, you know, to joke about a certain foreman. And they would, one day, a foreman came up to me and says, "Dieter, you're in the wrong field." And I went into trade school, and I did a poster for a class, and this same guy said, "Dieter, you're in the wrong field." And being from where I'm from...
That's a cool foreman.
Well, yeah. To cut to the chase, it came down to, in the back of my mind, I knew I wanted to do it, but when you're a tradesman where I'm growing up, being an artist and making a living off it, is that realistic when, you know, there's a guaranteed payday every Friday? Ultimately, I had to answer the question, and... I was in a cafe one night between jobs, and I saw a magazine called American Artist, I believe it was called. And there was an ad by the Institute of American Indian Arts, which I never heard of to that point. But there was this really cool picture of these warriors all lined up, and it was very contemporary looking. I went, "I'll take the shot." And they told me what to send, and I sent the package off. And I actually forgot about it and didn't think I was going to get in. I was actually expecting my rejection letter, to be quite honest, and... A letter of acceptance came, and next thing you know, I'm with a duffel bag and a black Stetson with my Eagle hat sitting in Minot, North Dakota, waiting for the Greyhound bus, and here I arrived, and
the rest is history, and you've become a very successful artist. You're a professor at Claflin University. You are you're going to the Venice Biennale Collateral Show. You have a very long history of exhibitions, and... You call yourself an Aboriginal storyteller, and you, George Alexander, also call yourself a storyteller. And I was wondering if you could both talk about what are some of the stories you want to tell and how you tell them through visual media.
I'm working on a series right now that I call Searching for Hesagadimisi, which means searching for God.
And I was wondering how you pronounce that.
Yeah. And in my tribe, we actually have two ways of saying God, which would be Ibofunga or Hesagmisi. And depending if you grew up like in a Christian aspect or a traditional aspect, you would use one or the other. And so my dad was a preacher, so I chose to use Hesagmisi for it. And this summer is whenever I started this series, and I kind of got this idea off of a movie, and... It got me thinking about like life's big questions of like who we are, where we're going, what's our purpose in life. And so my girlfriend recently just bought me a telescope, and so I started using that to kind of look at the stars. And I got this idea of like the stars kind of seeing more history than we all ever have, and that's kind of the reason why, like, when you look at the stars, you get kind of like in a deep thought. And it's the knowledge that the universe has kind of given you. And so then it kind of like made me wonder what it was that we were saying to back, what we were saying back. And I don't know if it's good or bad or not, you know. I would have to say that like we can kind of get mixed up in our own troubles or our own things that we do. And... we don't kind of look at the bigger picture of how we need to push mankind. And so I kind of used like space motifs, like astronauts, satellites, and everything, to represent this bigger understanding that we all kind of need to come together. And I mean, and then I use my traditional motifs to show us as people, as mankind, and that we're all indigenous to this earth. And we all need to kind of like just come together to push ourselves to a higher understanding, basically.
I find it fascinating, the idea of, I mean, you're looking at space and space is talking to you in some way. You know, you're looking through your telescope, and what are we saying back? Like, to whom?
Exactly, yeah.
You know?
You know, recently NASA just found out that there's another planet, Earth-like planet. It's like 1,400 light years away, and they named it Kepler 452b. And it's the closest Earth-like planet. And that's another thing that kind of got me sparked about this whole thing is, like, you know, what if these people are looking at us? What are they seeing? Are they seeing how caring and loving we are? Or are they seeing everything that we're kind of mixed up with, like, what's going on at Oakleaf Flat and what's going on in Canada with the missing women? And, you know, these are just indigenous things. Mm-hmm. And
right.
And or what happened in Ferguson, you know, like, those things other worldly people are seeing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And saying, dudes,
you guys need to get it together.
Right. And I think, you know, going on here, you mentioned a very important point. You know, I'm from that community of communities where those women are going missing. 1,200 missing across Canada. And where, you know, and are we human? I mean, you know, we keep in our communities asking, you know, the mainstream, these are real people missing here. What do you say as artists? What's our responsibility as artists? Do we stand there quietly or do we talk about things? And for myself, you know, I don't have those answers. I don't know. In fact, if I would think the older I'm getting, the less. There's an elder in my community we nicknamed Stoney. He's since went on, and one of the most important things he ever said that I remembered was, the older I get, the more I realize what I don't know.
It's funny, you brought to the table here, we're sitting here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, a digital piece that you did, which looks like an Indian with a big feather headdress, but it's almost like a robot metal suit. And what is it called? Bulletproof?
Oh, when I was 18 and bulletproof.
When I was 18 and yeah. Bulletproof. And it's
yeah.
Like that transition from thinking you know everything and are invincible to
sure.
a different kind of wisdom.
Sure. Yeah, George mentioned it too. You know, I think on the northern plains, as with in Oklahoma, a lot of us go through, especially us, you know, young men. I'll say it. The traditional way to put it is I can only speak for myself. So, you know, I grew up around a machismo bunch of guys. You know, we were we didn't have the warriors, the horses, and the paint, but we definitely challenged each other, you know, be it tribal or be it clans, and it was a way to stand up. And so many of my contemporaries that I grew up around that influenced me, some of them went on to greater things, some of them went to prison, some of them, you know, went on to school. And but I always remember the schoolyard was actually what set the tone, you know, for what you are in an adult. And I think, well, when I was 18 and bulletproof, was wandering around, the world was mine. I have wounds on my body from 18, and I lived and laughed about it and survived and whatever have you. But ultimately, now I'm looking back, I'm just lucky, you know, in a lot of cases that I'm even talking to you right now. You know, so.
We're talking to George Alexander and Anthony Dieter. And I wanted to ask you, George, I mean, your work comes from a lot of different influences, abstract expressionism, tattoo art and street art, iconic native imagery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of different roots. How do you put them together in a way that feels whole for you?
Well, it's just kind of like what Anthony keeps bringing up, his upbringing. And, you know, my parents passed away when I was 14, and I moved into the city with my sister, and growing up there, there's like different kind of people, and like you're mixed into this melting pot, and so you get influenced by these things, you know. And so I'm indigenous. I grew up in a city, and so these things, you know, they make me who I am. And I don't want to shun out those things and just make indigenous art, you know. I want people to know who it is that I am. You know, I grew up wanting to learn how to tattoo. At the age of 16, I made a little stick poke thing and tattooed all my friends with it. And then as I got older, I started messing around with, like, making little machines out of toothbrushes that, you know, go up and down and stuff. And so then that's kind of, like, how I got interested in art and everything. And that's pushed me to I, basically. So,
what kind of work are you doing now? Mostly painting?
Yeah, I'm a painter. That's where my main focus is. I'm also doing a lot of screen printing right now. I'm learning how to work with that media. And I've also learned how to do a little bit of jewelry action, too. So, yeah.
I was wondering if you could both talk about IAIA. I mean, George, you're a student there now, and Anthony, you went there and then you taught there, mm-hmm. and I think it was a very influential place for you.
It definitely was the catalyst for personal change. I guess I never saw a successful Native artist in my life. I'd seen talented Native artists. But when I came to Santa Fe, I mean, I was walking around the city and I was double taken. I mean, I was seeing them sitting in nice restaurants, driving nice cars. Their art was in galleries. You know, I was like, oh my gosh. I said, I'm in a dream world here. And I was greatly influenced by that. And the teachers at IA, when you arrived there, you know, I was doing the Northern Plains thing. I was drawing warriors on horseback, and I was, you know, everything like that, and eagles and bears and lions and tigers and bears, oh my. But my my instructor, my painting instructor, would take that painting quite literally, crumple it in his hands and throw it aside. So you already know how to do that. And I'll start to push that paint, get angry, yeah. get this, get that, get that. And I was, like, frustrating at first. And ultimately, I got what they were doing is they were pushing me out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And making me experiment with the medium. And then I started to pay attention because up to then, you know, I was a stubborn guy. I want to draw that. But Institute of American Indian Arts really, really changed the ball game for me personally and creatively, and something that I will always be appreciative of. So.
I kind of like... You know, I came there because I thought that I wanted to be, like, this Native traditional artist and everything. And, like, kind of what Anthony was saying, they crumple up that and kind of chunk it. Not to say that they don't like that stuff, but they definitely do push you to strive to make this dialogue that's more influenced to make you think of what's going on. They definitely focus on a lot of current issues. And I think that's very important. To push like the dialogue for Native artists, because a lot of people they think that, you know, Native art is just these pretty pictures of Indians in a headdress or pretty animals, but really we have a lot to say, you know.
Well, and the market for that kind of thing comes from a place of romanticism and not necessarily mm-hmm. seeing what the reality mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. and the complexity of that reality.
Exactly.
Is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they're starting to really, and especially the generation, I think George's generation particularly is really taking the ball and running, because, you know, I have a joke back home that says, in my generation, Creedence Clearwater Revival was the anthem of Indian country in the 70s, okay? And there's a way our cars look. There's a way our dogs act. There's a way we dress, you know, and if you recognize it, you can always tell who's from where by just certain little aesthetics. And I think that storytelling component now is starting to come across. You know, they're saying, oh yeah, I totally relate to that, or that song I relate to, or, you know, and we're starting to get into the very contemporary Native individual now. There's the romanticism has got a lot of mileage, and I think it still, you know, has a place, but at the same time, we are current, we are contemporary, we are here, and
I mean,
we survive.
If you were to walk into the studio right now at the II, you would see like a lot of different influences from a lot, like, different music and where people grew up and their interests, and they kind of like tie it all together with their indigenous traits, and it shows that we're not those people that we were hundreds of years ago. We're not living in teepees. We're not riding on horses. Or 50 years ago, you know, it's not that long ago. And that's important, because it shows that we're modern and contemporary, and we're pushing the boundaries of art.
You know, something that I wanted to ask you both about, I mean, if there's one thing that I think a lot of Native people, a lot of Indigenous people have in common, it's that they come from communities where collectivism is more important than individualism. And when you get into the art world, it's so much about individual expression. And I wondered how you, like, think about your role as an individual and your role as part of a collective, being an artist.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because I think the conception that when you become a, you know, an established artist or a recognized artist, that automatically your ego goes up by about, you know, 20 degrees. And in the communities, again, I can only speak where I'm from, it is collective. For instance, myself as an artist is one role within a society that for a generation, the role of an artist within Native American culture has actually been one of great importance. And but then so is the role of the man who's going out there and who's delivering to the houses the water, or is driving the truck, or is all these little aspects that keep a community going that we take for granted and go, well, this person may be in a more important position. It's not that I'm in a more important position whatsoever. It's that this is my role. And I was telling the artist that the other day. I was saying, you know, it doesn't make an individual any better than anybody when you're an artist and you're recognized for your work. It just means you have an avenue to speak perhaps for your people through that, and you think it becomes a voice perhaps.
Yeah. I think that me being an artist allows me to speak on behalf of myself, and then being indigenous allows me to speak amongst my people, and I can push what it is that we feel is important as indigenous people towards the world, and I can use my voice and the things that I've been through in my own personal experience to add to that dialogue, basically. And that's kind of how I feel.
It's really important. I mean, I think, you know, when you talk about who you're reaching with your voice and speaking for your people, you know, are you speaking to your people? Are you speaking to outsiders? It really strikes me that so few people even know about these missing women, for example, mm-hmm. whereas everybody knows about the missing women in Juarez, Mexico.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why that is, you know, because how many do you think there are?
I know that in Canada alone there's 1,200 missing now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we haven't even tallied up Mexico, as you say, or what's happening in the U.S., and I think there's a... I mean, let me reverse the question. Put that in any other culture within these borders here. Put that in Rhode Island or Maine.
Yeah.
What would be the outcry?
Yeah.
You'd see that everywhere on CNN.
Yeah.
And it's just not Native American people that kind of get shunned out. But, I mean, a couple years ago with Belamonte in Brazil, you know, that barely made news, and they're building this huge dam, and they're moving indigenous people of the Amazon off of their homeland because they got to build this dam, and it's going to be 10,000 square miles that's going to be completely filled up with water, you know? And they don't ever put that consideration that these people live here and they're free to do that. I mean, who gives them the right to move somebody off of their land, you know?
Right.
I thought we were past this already, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If I may say, you know, the romanticism may have been a bit of a handicap, because people see us, if I won't say romanticize you, you're still yesteryear. What the mainstream may not know is a significant portion of this country has been built by Native Americans. Mm-hmm. The steel workers who built the skyscrapers of New York City, the steel workers who are working in Western Canada building in the highways in the tar sands, the controversial tar sands. And I know this because I've been there with my cousin's crews.
Yeah.
And while we're in the news, they're not saying, you know, a significant portion of this country, there's Native tradesmen out there risking their necks and putting, you know, the food on the table. And incredible amount of this country has been built by our tradesmen, but we don't get that recognition.
Right, and the whole question of what is being destroyed, mm-hmm. and for whom, mm-hmm. and for what purposes,
right.
and how short-sighted those things are.
Exactly.
Is, you know, I just feel like those are issues where Native voices should be central.
Right, and you know, I think we have a tendency, too, to think of us against the mainstream, and I hate to use the word white, because that's also, to me, racial, because the white race is many cultures, right? But, you know, within this country's borders are other nations and other peoples that still are, because of the mainstream misconception in the books and et cetera, they also misconstrue us. And I've had people of ethnicities actually ask me questions that I wouldn't dream of answering. I'm like, you don't understand us, but yet you're here brand new. You're brand new in this country, and you're asking me that question.
So like
you,
what?
Oh, I've had people from other parts of the world, I won't give, you know, come here and, you know, say, you Aboriginals, you don't like to work.
Oh,
you know,
God.
Or things like that, or we heard that you're such and such, you know, and I'm going, but you guys should know better. You were persecuted in your own countries. You come here for a better life and lesson learned. You come over here and you start doing the same thing to, dare I say it.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think that it was a racism type of thing, but more of like a classism issue. Mm. And, you know, because, I mean, anybody that comes from a province-stricken area would stand up for what they believe is right, or vice versa, you know. And when you say like who's fighting for what, basically, and you know, indigenous people fight for our land and the earth, or everything in between. You know, me personally, I just feel that like everybody should just come together and not worry about anything in particular, but like a main cause, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to George Alexander and Anthony Dieter, and both of them are part of Indigenous Fine Art Market, which starts today and goes through Saturday. It's Thursday and Friday from 10 in the morning until 10 at night, and Saturday from 10 to 4:30 at the rail yard. Now, what kinds of work are each of you going to be showing?
I'm going to be definitely showing the series that I've been working on for the past summer, which is the Searching for Hisagonimisi, or God, and along with some other work that goes outside of the series. My booth will be 108 at the rail yard, so if you want to come check it out, I'll be there.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. I've actually returned to my roots this time around. I thought about bringing the digital thing, being that's kind of my bread and butter as a teacher, but I returned to painting in this series, and the painting series is actually about a lot of the very questions you asked, the contemporary aspects of my life, some of my experiences, some of the individuals I've interfaced with, including the questions of a higher power, etc., etc. I did say I'd put in a little thing. I want to tell my students at Claflin University that, and at the Institute of American Indian Arts, you're the best, and believe that you're the best.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And by the way, you can find out more about Indigenous Fine Art Market at indigifam.org. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.